please join us at our Global Flood Seminar in Denver at the Brown Palace. Bob Inyart Live and Real Science Radio are hosting this scientific look at the Genesis Flood of Noah's Day from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday, November 29th. Registration is $20 or $30 for the family. Reserve a seat online at kgov.com, that's kgov.com, or pay at the door or call now 800-8-ENYART, that's 800-836-9278. See you there.
Intelligent design and DNA. The scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Inyart. Now, in 2014, this fall, CMI has outdone themselves with the release of a stunning video. 15 PhD scientists explaining evolution's fatal flaws in the DVD Evolution's Achilles Heels. Now, this video and book project was conceived of and the video co-produced by Dr. Carter. And so to discuss evolution's Achilles Heels, Dr. Rob Carter, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Thanks, Bob, for having me back.
Well, what an honor and fabulous video. Boy, did I enjoy watching this video just yesterday, and I've been going through the book. The book is 9 PhD scientists explain evolution's fatal flaws, and you have chapter 2 on genetics and DNA. Dr. Carter, perhaps we could begin there with the size of the DNA molecule. The size that is in bits of information, it is stunning.
Well, how do you want to start? There's so many different ways to describe it.
Well, the length of it, you point out in your book that if we printed out the human genome as text, it would take approximately 850 Bibles worth of pages to print out the DNA in a single cell.
Or how about this one? If you took the DNA and made it as wide as a human hair, you'd have 32 miles of hair.
Oh, my.
Packed into something the size of a golf ball.
Oh, my. 32.
And you have that in every single cell of your body.
32, and we have about 100 trillion cells in an adult human. But you point out that DNA, well, it's such a fine strand. It's not especially durable. And especially a single strand of DNA would really break uncontrollably.
It's an incredibly fragile molecule. And some of those single molecules are over a foot long inside your cell.
Oh. The way it was designed to help it be more robust is instead of being a single strand of information to code for proteins and other things, it's a double strand, the double helix. That makes it a bit stronger. Is that true?
Only a little bit stronger.
Because it still breaks, right?
Oh yeah. You've got about a million, they call them lesions, inside every one of your cells every single day. Single strand breaks, double strand breaks, oxygen destroying little bits and pieces of it that have to be fixed.
So about a million breaks in our DNA in every cell every day, that would be catastrophic. We would die if those breaks were not repaired.
DNA cannot exist without DNA repair enzymes. But that's an origin of life argument, which is chapter 3 in the book, Evolution's Achilles Heels. Without a system of maintaining it, it can't evolve in the first place. And yet the system for maintaining it is coded in the DNA, so we have a giant chicken and egg problem. What came first, the DNA or the things that are required to maintain the DNA?
An enzyme typically is a rather sophisticated protein. That's the way I think of it anyway.
Yes.
Different kinds of enzymes repair different kinds of damage to our DNA.
Yes.
And there's a whole set of enzymes to repair these different kinds of damaged chunks of DNA. All that is necessary, I'm trying to grasp what you just said, for us to use DNA, because otherwise it would just constantly break down. And like you said, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, he authored chapter 3 of the book. You're the editor of the book, Evolution's Achilles Heels. But the chicken and egg problem, if we're going to evolve the use of DNA to code for proteins and really sophisticated proteins like enzymes, how could that possibly happen if we need the enzymes to constantly repair it? If the enzymes have to wait thousands or millions of years to evolve once DNA got going, it's an impossible problem. There can be no solution. That's my understanding of it.
That's our contention, in fact. But you even made a giant concession for the evolutionists there. You said once DNA got going, how do you get DNA going?
Right.
The chemical system, you're not going to get polymerization like that. It's going to break down very quickly because water destroys it.
Water destroys it. So when Darwin imagined that life might have begun in some warm pond somewhere.
He knew nothing about chemistry.
He didn't, nor about genetics, right? DNA?
That's the funniest thing. That the father of evolutionary theory knew nothing about how traits are passed from one generation to the next. Evolution was invented in a vacuum of knowledge.
And the more we've now learned about the sophistication of molecular biology and DNA, has it been a boon for the Darwinist? Are they thrilled with the increasing information? Or it seems to me, Dr. Carter, that it's the creationists that are ecstatic with every new discovery in molecular biology.
Yeah, a lot of our predictions have turned out to be true. A lot of our armchair rumination, just sitting back, I wonder if this is this and this, you know, 20, 30 years ago. A lot of that's true. But the real problem is evolution might work if life is simple. But the more complex life becomes, the less explanatory power evolution has. And all we have learned in the last 10 or 20 years is life is unbelievably complex and it gets worse every day.
It gets worse, meaning it's more and more complex.
Our understanding of its complexity is only increasing over time. Mm. And it makes evolution almost laughable just because it cannot work on such a complex system.
A couple years ago, I got to write a review, a 40 years later analysis of Theodosius Dobzhansky, his article, Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution. It was published in the CRSQ, which was an honor. And in there, I just made a passing observation, the wild complexity of molecular biology, there's no complexity there just for the sake of complexity. It's actually sophistication. There's a brilliant streamlining of what needs to be done in order to implement life in a robust fashion. So it's not just like a Rube Goldberg machine that's needlessly complex. It's wildly
something that evolutionists might predict. If life is just cobbled together from bunches of accidents over time, you might expect a very unwieldy, inefficient, complex system to do something.
Mm.
But it's not what we find. We find optimization. When we look at the way things happen, how about overlapping? You can say one piece of DNA, and that same piece of DNA can code for multiple different things at the same time. I mean, different languages are written into DNA. It's not just protein. There's a lot of other languages. And so you can read something, and it can tell you something in Swedish and something in Swahili.
It's thrilling because, as Kepler is paraphrased, that he was thinking God's thoughts after him.
Oh, man, yes.
When we are reading the DNA, it's a language, it's multiple languages written on top of one another that we're still struggling to decode, to understand, but we are reading God's thoughts. We're thinking God's thoughts after him. We're seeing what kind of a programmer he is. And Dr. Carter, I worked for Microsoft for a while. I was a liaison between Microsoft and IBM for their PC networking operating systems. So I studied programming at Arizona State University. When I read your work and the work of others about the programming in our DNA, and there's not only a genetic code, there's a sugar code, there are other codes. It's brilliance on top of brilliance on top of brilliance. It's mind-boggling, the sophistication of it all.
You're talking about thinking God's thoughts after him. When we got into the human genome, we realized we cannot think God's thoughts because he's so far above us.
Hmm.
We're staring at the human genome saying, how on earth does this work? And the bits and pieces that we figured out are not what people were predicting 20 years ago. If you think about it, okay, so you program computers. Computers, we write lines of code.
Yeah.
And a line in mathematics is a one-dimensional object, but the human genome is not just a line of DNA because the DNA folds up into three-dimensional shape. And different parts of the genome interact with other parts of the genome, making this two-dimensional network. And then the DNA actually changes over time. It changes shape over time.
Right.
As if you need a different gene active at one point.
As far as a materialist explanation of how you would get a code to be recorded on a DNA molecule, and that code then would help to build proteins, amino acid by amino acid. I've interviewed twice recently Dr. Stephen Meyer from the Discovery Institute on his book, Darwin's Doubt. He knows a lot about molecular biology. I asked him a question. I'd like to ask you the question, Dr. Carter. It's a statement, and if you could comment. It seems that the atheist, materialist, they don't even have a proposal of how a code began, how the scheme of amino acid sequences are represented on a DNA strand by genetic letters. They don't even have a proposal, theoretically, a rough algorithm of how such a scheme could have begun. Am I overstating the case, or they have their RNA world, but I've not seen a claim that, well, maybe this is how the scheme started.
You're absolutely right. They have a blank slate, and they invoke magic, and now we have life.
Wow. Now that's
when I say magic, I mean the origin of that first reproducing cell.
Yeah.
Flies in the face of everything we know about experimental chemistry, physics, information theory, probability, biology. There's nothing they can appeal to in experimental science to explain how life started. Hmm. And that's just the most possible, simplest life anyone could imagine. And if you go beyond that, maybe there was a molecule that could self-replicate. Well, there are no molecules today that can self-replicate. Hmm. But they've got to have a molecule that can make copies of itself.
Right.
Even that is so, I mean, it's so unimaginably complicated that they're invoking something that's really, you know, then a miracle occurs is essentially what they're saying.
Your answer, Dr. Carter, was clear and precise. No, they don't even have a rough algorithm. And I was thinking that's what Dr. Stephen Meyer would say. He didn't exactly answer the question. But to describe the scheme, like the instructions for building a protein would be written on a different molecule, letter by letter, and then that would be transcribed and be built into a protein. That scheme, which is essential for all known life, not even a proposal. I mean, I could propose how you could get to the moon by building a tall ladder. I could propose it. It's not going to work, but I could start. They can't even start. They haven't even started on a scheme to get genetic information written into a molecule. Wow.
What do they have? Maybe random chemical reactions can make random molecules, and eventually they'll make a random molecule that actually says, do something.
Yeah.
But it's irrelevant, because one instruction without a context, or one instruction without, you know, thousands of other instructions also doing things towards a goal, is going to give you nothing.
Was it?
Or imagine you had a computer program that just randomly wrote text strings.
Right.
And eventually, you're looking for the phrase "I love my mother," or "go feed the dog," or anything. Even if it finally does produce an intelligible sentence with an instruction, that instruction is nothing because you don't even have a dog, you don't have a mother, you don't have anything to go by.
You don't have anything to read it, anything to understand it. You don't have the context, the environment.
Yeah, there's no context.
The environment required for life is so sophisticated. I'm not sure which of the PhD scientists in the video, it might have been Don Batten. He said, I think it was him, that initially they thought maybe there were 200 proteins to make a simple living cell. Now it's up to about 400. But if the entire universe was a laboratory where every atom was running an experiment to create a single protein molecule, in the claimed age of the universe, 14 billion years, you're not even going to get a single protein. But even if you did, it would be nothing. It would just be a protein that wouldn't be able to do anything, because you need hundreds of proteins for the simplest of life.
That's right. And pick a protein, amylase, breaks down sugars. Hey, I made amylase. Hooray.
Yeah,
what does that do you? It does you nothing.
Right, exactly. So then could we talk about the topic of genetic entropy that a scientist from Cornell, John Sanford, has made so popular with his book, Genetic Entropy. He's in your video. It's brilliant, but it's also tragic. You guys point out that a 60-year-old person, because every time our cells divide, we gain mutations. By the time you're 60, you have about 40,000 mutations in every cell. 40,000. And yet God so brilliantly engineered human reproduction that when we have children, for the most part, even though they do suffer, every generation inherits more mutational breakdown, those children are protected from the vast majority of the mutational breakdown that we're suffering from. How does that happen?
Well, the reason for that is that we don't inherit our parents' skin cells. We'd already be extinct if we did.
We'd be extinct because our parents' skin cells would have many thousands, tens of thousands of mutations.
Yes. Most of the protection actually comes from the female's egg cells because they don't divide in the ovary. They're held in protective stasis for decades.
Wow.
The men, though, our luteal reproductive cells divide like crazy after puberty. And the evidence in science shows that the older a man is when he has a child, the more mutations he passes on to his children.
Which makes sense from what we know about genetics and cell division. And
yeah,
you point out,
every time a cell divides, the little molecular machines that make copies of the DNA, they make mistakes.
Yeah, they're
so
doing
the more cell divisions you have, the more mistakes are in the cell.
They're doing a fabulous job. I mean,
well, an amazing job. One out of a billion. I mean, copy a billion letters and make one mistake. I wish I could type like that.
Yeah, right. And it's almost like you're going into a library and asking the copy center. You're saying this stack of books here in this rack, 850 books, each one the size of the Bible. I'd like a copy of them. Make a copy. And so they start copying them. But while they're copying them, the books are still being used by people in the library, and they have to keep track of where they stop, where they started. Okay, you're done. Now I got to copy that. And they do all that, and they make about three letters, only not three books worth of errors, just three letters when they're done. So it's an astounding precision even after the fall, after corruption entered our ecosystem because of Adam and Eve's sin. It's still amazingly precise, but there are errors. But you said that when a baby girl is in her mother's womb, she has all her ova. Each of those ovum is complete. And in your book, you point out that after 23 cell divisions, that's it, from when the little girl is a single-celled organism, after that cell divides now 23 times, that by then the ovaries are complete. They're done.
Yeah. I learned that from an evolutionist named Mike Lynch.
Okay.
He's got an interesting, very interesting paper about mutation accumulation in people.
Wow. That means that by then the genetic integrity of that little girl's eggs or ova is in place. And so even though mutations will continue in her body for the next 30, 40 years, those eggs will be virtually pristine.
Virtually, yes.
Wow. And
now,
so,
okay, now that throws another curveball into this, into evolutionary theory, natural selection, and Darwin's ideas.
Yeah.
When you have a woman who's pregnant with a girl, there are three generations present at the same time.
Three generations of genomes present?
The mother, the daughter, and her eggs. And things that are happening in the environment of the mother are affecting the baby and might be affecting the egg cells also. So if the mother has something toxic or lots of stress or if she smokes or she eats too much, that's actually affecting genetic expression of the eggs inside the ovary of the baby girl.
Wow.
And so you can have a child born, 45 years later for a late ovulation who is affected because of the environment of grandma.
And when the Bible says that the sins of the fathers are passed down to multiple generations, that's sort of an illustration of that. It's a biological one.
Parallel.
Yeah,
But what it means is that Darwinian evolution's got a big problem. It's called epigenetics. Upon genetics is what that means. It means that there are things that are designed to influence the way we act and behave and the way we look and the way we genetically we express things that are coming from the environment.
Mm.
This is going back to Lamarck, the inheritance of acquired characteristics.
Right. Lamarck thought, in fact, Darwin thought, I learned from reading one of your other works, maybe an article, that sailors and watchmakers, Darwin claimed that watchmakers' children, they'd be nearsighted better, and sailors' children would be farsighted better.
Right. And, well, because we know those, he said, we know those traits are highly heritable.
Right, which was false.
But it wasn't genetics for him. It was because of the use or disuse of the eyes was affecting the farsightedness or nearsightedness, and that was just traveling down into the child.
It was sort of like if a giraffe-like creature kept stretching its neck to eat higher leaves, then he'd be born with...
Yeah, it's ridiculous on one hand, but on the other hand, it's come full circle.
Because epigenetics
means
right.
that the environment influences how the individual looks and behaves. In fact, epigenetic systems in the body are designed to produce an effect, and the effects they produce are usually greater than an average mutation. So natural selection is looking at an organism and killing it or not killing it, not based on the genetics, but based on the environment. So natural selection all of a sudden is blind, and it can't do what Darwin needs it to do. In other words, you can have two identical twins that have had different environmental influences, and natural selection might kill one of them off and right. let the other one live because they're acting or behaving a little differently, but they still are identical genetically.
And these epigenetic influences on our genome, they exhibit all the characteristics of being pre-programmed switches, switches that are turned on or turned off based on input, and they're temporary. They can be turned on and off back and forth, and that's nothing like Darwinism. That shows the expression of predetermined or pre-programmed phenotypes, the ability of the organism to respond in a defined way to his environment.
In a very complex way, and it, we often can't predict what might happen, but they're designed mechanisms to produce change. It's like, wait a minute, what do you mean design change? Yeah, of course design change, because creationists don't believe the species don't change. That's nonsense.
right.
Creationists have written at least, I think, 80 years before Darwin is the earliest reference I've found in Linnaeus's work about species changing over time.
Hmm.
Darwin was fighting Aristotle, who taught that species don't change over time,
right.
not the Bible.
Right, and that is so common. The church gets blamed for the teachings of Plato, that the sun went around the earth, and the teachings of Aristotle, the fixity of species because of an obsession with the immutability of species. And so often the church is blamed for things that secular science had taught for millennia even.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that so many scientists in the day were also in the church, and the two were blended in such a way it's hard to tell them apart in a lot of times.
Right, exactly.
But it takes a naive view of history to draw the conclusion that the church made all those errors. But, if you really look at it, it's like, wait a minute, that's not derived from Scripture. Is derived from the science of the day, which was wrong.
Stop the tape. Hey, this is Bob Enyar interrupting my own interview with Dr. Rob Carter. How rude of me. Actually, we have so much to share that we decided to do this over two broadcasts. So next week, Lord willing, tune in for part two of my interview with Dr. Rob Carter on Evolution's Achilles Heels, the video and the book. Tomorrow, we will be at the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver with our Global Flood Seminar. So if you can possibly make it, I think you'll have a wonderful time. We can't wait. We've done the seminar before. People absolutely love it. It's on Saturday, November 29th, downtown Denver at the historic Brown Palace Hotel, 9 a.m. to 4. It's $20 registration, $30 for a family. We will show astounding animations of the creation of the firmament with the waters below and the waters above. And then the waters below the firmament that were reserved for the judgment of the global flood. And we will see the scientific evidence for the erupting of the fountains of the great deep that explains the major features of the Earth's surface. It is so exciting to go to God's word and to trust that he has given us an accurate record of the history of the earth. And then we go to the sciences of paleontology and geology. We see dinosaur soft tissue. We see short-lived carbon-14 and diamonds. We see polystrate fossils. We see the flat gaps in the Grand Canyon. And we could understand these in the context of the sacred history recorded in the Bible, and especially in the book of Genesis. So our seminar tomorrow on the global flood at Denver's historic Brown Palace Hotel. It's exciting. Please come on out. You are cordially invited. It's $20 registration for an individual and for a family, the whole family, mom, dad, the kids, cousins, nieces, nephews, grandparents. Bring the dog. Well, they might not allow the dog. Bring the whole family. It's $30 for a family. So further details at our website, realscienceradio.com. Until tomorrow and until next week, this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYART. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist, Dr. Eugenie Scott on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist? Bob Enyart debates atheist Zaketh, a psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYART, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department, either at kgov.com or realscienceradio.com.